Robin, how have you been? You gained a lot of fame because everyone knows you from an interview with Eric Clapton, I think.
Yeah, good to be here. Good to talk to you. This time, I think we tried before a few months ago, but I wasn't able to do that. I believe that you may be interested in me mentioning the midazolam situation in the UK.
Absolutely.
Now, I will talk to it in just so things happening. I will just talk to it a bit from, let's say, the hat of being someone who runs a channel. Mm-hmm. A channel with about almost 85,000 subscribers and a lot of people who send things to the channel. So that's the direction I will address it from. Everything I know about this subject of midazolam has been published in the channel. There is no further information that I am holding on to secretly. And the channel can be used as a search engine. So if you go on Telegram or t.me/RobinMG, which are my initials, you can then press the three red dots on the top right, enter a search for midazolam, and you will find quite a number of different posts on this subject.
Robin, can you explain, because you're an architect and a film producer, how did you get into this?
Well, I was alerted by the direction that this was taken early on. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons why I felt that I had more information than anybody else is that in my own family, we had a very out of the ordinary respiratory infections, a crossover between December 2019 and January 2020, which turned into two cases, including me, of bilateral lung infection, almost unprecedented high temperature that I had not had since being a child, perhaps. And so that drew me to having a look at what we were given. At least the most severe case was given in our family at the time, before we knew or before we were told so much about this alleged coronavirus. And when I looked at the prescription, there was azithromycin in it, which was part of the by then developing later the Zelenko protocol, which included this substance. And so I realized that actually there was existing knowledge of how to treat a generic respiratory infection with a viral matrix, let's say, a viral beginning, which, as happens in pretty much all severe respiratory infections, then becomes a co-infection with a number of different pathogens, which may be viruses or bacteria or usually all at the same time. And that's what a pneumonia generally is. It's not a virus, it's not SARS or the only element that leads to the pneumonia. It's actually a co-infection of a number of different things. And that would make sense with the introduction of this azithromycin in what we were given at the time, which changed the course of the disease pretty much dramatically, in the sense that about 1.5 days after that, after this administration, the temperature started to steadily go down until we recovered. And so there was a clear indication that this type of antibiotic clearly works with this type of, I would say, unusual respiratory infection. At the same time, there were calls by governments about staying home. And there, you know, my basic knowledge of vitamin D, I started looking into it and realized that actually it's what you need for your T cells to actually fight these infections. Therefore, if you want to reduce both the personal severity and also the immunological sense of the spread of this disease, because obviously if every individual body is an immune system, if you if you heighten that immune system, you will stop the so-called epidemic. So the idea that you lock yourself at home and that's how you stop it, it was actually in the spring of the Northern Hemisphere, it was actually the other way around. Everyone going out would stop it in the fastest possible way because it would boost vitamin D, it would boost T cells. Most people would end up with possibly asymptomatic or slightly symptomatic and recover very quickly, and the whole thing was over. So a combination of these elements got me to look into it and got me to look at the scientific articles. Having a background in academia, I was quite versed in research. And that's when I started using my Twitter account, again, as a search engine. So whatever I would find that was not being shown, let's say, by official media, I would publish on my account and link to it. And so that's what my Twitter account became. It became a search engine. At some stage, it was clear through me presenting it at a search engine and also the data that I was starting to share information, that what we were told were vaccines, in fact, did not work as what we conventionally know as what a vaccine should do. Therefore, the clear conclusion was to do with language. If these do not work as vaccines, then we should not call them vaccines. They are not vaccines. The moment I started saying that, I started being subjected to continuous bans, maybe about, I don't know, 10, 20 bans, until at some stage with no justification, the accounts were off online. And then we started I already was on a Telegram channel at the same time, and then moved on to all of that. So that's how it all happened. Basically, that is as a citizen participating in civic society. And I chose to participate in civic society through this technology. Going back to that aspect at the beginning, the aspect of the issue of midazolam is, in brief, from what I have understood through what has been shared on the Telegram channel, is that there has been, and this probably you know it already, but I'll just go very quickly through it. There's been an unprecedented acquisition of doses of midazolam around March 2020. This is proved in videos and government documents, videos showing government officials and government documents on the Telegram channel that show this effort at buying this midazolam, justifying it to do with facilitating a painless death. That was generally the logic that was given. But this was unprecedented. And at the same time, documents have been published through articles that came on the channel showing that, and this is actually, it's common knowledge whenever you look into it, that a combination of midazolam with morphine-based products leads to respiratory suppression, including death. Therefore, at some stage, if you are trying to say that there is a respiratory epidemic and you indicate to maybe staff that don't know much better, because obviously there is a so-called new virus and therefore the protocol is new, and if the new protocol includes an administration of both midazolam and a morphine-based product in quantities and doses, which again seem to be unprecedented through the documents that have been published on the channel, it seems clear that without an autopsy, it is pretty much impossible to attribute any death that was given of COVID-19 to COVID-19 as opposed to midazolam and morphine-based product, and unless you have a clinical file of the person who was in the care home of the hospital, an up-to-date, a precise clinical file. And if you can exclude from that these drugs have been given, then maybe perhaps you start to privilege that there was another nature of the possible death, which wasn't. But until you do that, until you do the autopsy, all of these deaths that we are told are COVID-19 are in a huge question. The other reason for the possible death is, as we all know by now, is the withdrawal of treatment. As I said, I have personally witnessed on my own skin the effect of pretty much straightforward antibiotic on a bilateral pneumonia with very, very high temperature, which was called at the time, when there were no tests at the time, it was said, you know, the doctor said, this is a viral infection. I cannot confirm what virus it is. Since then, I've looked into coronaviruses in general, and the data says that 49%, so almost 50% of all coronavirus infections are co-infections of different viruses. So it starts to matter less and less whatever virus makes you ill, because it can be many. So at that stage, I thought, what can we do to address this in a very basic way that people can understand, in order to prevent something like this from happening again? Because if they can do it once, they can do it again. So as a start, I said, well, let's sort of write a different protocol for society to keep it open. And I called it with my name. I said, I'll just call it the Menotti Protocol for keeping society open. Point one would be, we absolutely have to stop any asymptomatic tests for any respiratory infection. Either you have the symptoms, or this is a hugely dangerous path to tread, to start testing randomly, for a lot of different reasons, including Bayes theory, probability theory, and all of that. Number two was, when you are subject to respiratory infection season, take vitamin D, but not what the UK government said, which was 400 IUs per day, a minimum of 2000 IUs per day. Otherwise, it will make no difference. Step three was avoid hospitals, because that's where diseased people are. So that's where the highest viral loads, the biggest chances of being infected by anything, not only this virus, but other viruses, bacteria, superbugs. Hospitals are the places where these things are, because six people who are sick enough to go to hospital end up there. So avoid hospitals and just dispense treatments in pharmacies for such things, as happened pretty much to us at Keurig. So that's how I got to all of that. At the same time, I've been thinking about the language that we use in general. And when you talk to people about all of this, you are faced with a lot of resistance. And one of the questions that is being given is, oh, but, you know, there was a pandemic, there was a public health emergency. So there I suggest that actually we all need to make an effort to say things as they are, in the most honest way possible, regardless of the brutality of the truth. So in that sense, I would encourage people to, whenever they hear, oh, there's a pandemic or public health emergency, just say, oh, you mean the crimes against humanity? Because that's what we are talking about. And if only I say it, people may laugh at it. If I say it, people may be shocked. If we all say it, if we all start saying it very, very clearly in day-to-day conversation, but in a normal way, it's just in a normal way, because for us, there actually is no doubt about this. And why I think there is no doubt about it is because they've admitted to it. When Bill Gates says, you think you have a choice, but you don't have a choice to get a medical intervention. That is a systematic call for violation of human rights. And coming from someone who's so involved with world governments and pharmaceutical companies, there is no doubt that that is a systematic incitement to a crime against humanity. At the same time, when Macron says, I want to piss off those who exercise informed consent, that is again a systematic call to a violation of human rights, because you as a government official cannot violate this informed consent without committing a human rights violation, therefore a crime. And if you, as a president of a country, say it, you are effectively, again, inciting for a systematic mass violation of human rights, therefore a crime against humanity. And I could write a PhD on the amount of crimes against humanity that are being committed right now. And a number of different sort of covenants and agreements. The most obvious one for me is the UNESCO Universal Declaration of Bioethics and Human Rights, 2005, Article 6, because it uses clearly the words preventive, diagnostic, and therapeutic. Therefore, with preventive, we mean tests. We mean masks. With diagnostic, we mean tests. With therapeutic, we mean any form of injection. Requires an informed consent, not just a consent, an informed consent, and therefore, without that information, it is already a human rights violation. Without that consent, it is a further human rights violation. At the same time, I find that people are not aware of these rights that they have. So it's a lot of it our work to, again, bring this into daily public conversation and remind people that they are not walking vectors of disease. They are human beings with human rights that need to be respected with dignity. And these rights need to be acknowledged. If they're not acknowledged, if they're violated, then this is what leads to, in a systematic way, a crime against humanity. And the fact that governments throughout the West, at least, and in some cases the East, are all involved in systematic crimes against humanity, does not mean that this is acceptable, does not mean that these rights have been stripped up and that they are no longer relevant. It actually means that they are all criminals. And as they are all criminals, we need to call them out. And it is pretty much our job to remind people that they can withdraw any consent, even to a simple face mask, at any time without suffering any disadvantage or prejudice. Now, obviously, this shifts the whole debate elsewhere from the efficacy and the toxicity of vaccines to a discourse of human rights. At that debate, the other side will claim such things like public health emergencies and will claim that under such public health emergencies, some of these human rights can be suspended. But I think I welcome any debate on that level, because I think on that level, we would win any form of debate, because they have really no argument, in the sense that if we forget about the beginning, let's say March 2020, and we talk about it today, if you compare any data that they provide, which we know is vitiated by all sorts of methodological problems, it is significantly better than the same data last year. And therefore, the notion of emergency would not be proportional anyway. At the same time, we have had enough time to establish an infection fatality rate for this pathogen, which is in the same order as seasonal flu, 0.1%. So even on that term, there is no basis for a public health emergency, on the basis that there is not enough staff, and therefore that is how we base the emergency. Well, then we have the evidence everywhere that staff are losing their jobs because their human right to not give consent is being violated, and they are told they need to leave their jobs unless they submit to this. So on that premise as well, they have no ground to claim that there is any public health emergency which would justify any proportional measure to such an extreme extent, such as suspension of Article 6 of this UNESCO. So I don't think they have anything to stand, no ground to stand on. At the same time, I was posting yesterday something by Alexander Redko, who was the head doctor of St. Petersburg Hospital, who has apparently 200 research articles under his names. And he basically said, look, you know, if we understand a pandemic as a widespread epidemic, in his numbers, an epidemic would require 5% of the population sick all at the same time. And his claim is that COVID was 7% over 2 years, therefore 3.5% per year average. And therefore, even according to his numbers, you know, this does not qualify as a pandemic or epidemic. And we all know the fact that the original term pandemic required a lot of difference, you know, huge number of deaths all at the same time. And they removed that and they turned it into sort of things like case numbers for, again, a whole methodological aspect, which is you cannot suddenly say there is a public health emergency and base it on numbers of mass testing when this mass testing was not happening the year before, because you don't have anything to compare it to. Apart from the UNESCO, we have, and these are all things that you know very well, Rainer, but I think it's important for people to know, there's the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, 1966, which has been enforced since 1976. And Article 7 that says no one should be subjected to any medical experimentation without their consent. Article 26 says the law shall prohibit any discrimination on any ground or opinion or status. which obviously therefore applies to vaccinated or whatever you may call it, injected status at the same time. Then we have, of course, other agreements, the Helsinki Declaration, the Nuremberg Code. So I think we've got a lot of confirmation that this is our human right to informed consent and to have no disadvantage or prejudice. So it's clear that this is being violated and these are crimes against humanity. At the same time, when it comes to new rights, an aspect that I started going back into my own original professional hat, which is to do with architecture and urbanism, which is the aspect of surveillance. And because it's quite new, this aspect of surveillance, the question I have is, not only I believe we need to hold on to our existing human rights, I think we need to consider further ones in order to try and defend ourselves from the onslaught of what is called the smart city and the surveillance capitalism that we are living under. Now, why I say this is because we are talking about vaccine passports here, but this is just one of the myriad of possibilities that they have in order to control the population. We may even end up winning this one on vaccine passports in some countries, and it may snowball to other countries. I believe that will happen sooner or later. But even if we do that, the moment the infrastructure is ready around the city to do with both surveillance, facial recognition, QR codes on entry of most places, the moment that is ready, they can engineer any form of, again, shock emergency, and almost over a weekend say you have to do this again to sort of protect the population. And it can come in any, for some examples, maybe some scaremongering about world temperatures and that needs a carbon passport to go in, and only if you don't use enough carbon dioxide then you can go to certain shops. And at the same time, it could be there could be a number of terrorist attacks, and they could say, well, it becomes too unsafe for anyone with a coat or anything can go into a shop unless they have a QR code, and then the QR code proves they're not terrorists. So I think that is a bit of an issue that we should be already addressing. In 2013, Boris Johnson rolled out the Smart London Plan. In 2018, Sadiq Khan launched the Smarter London Together, a roadmap to make London the smartest city in the world. The current state that we are in is that in London, if you look at CCTV cameras per square mile, it's only second to Delhi, and we've got 1,138. If you look at cameras per person, it's number three after Taiwan and walks in China, and London is at 73 cameras per 1,000 people. At the end of August, the mayor of London City kind of approved a proposal allowing the London Metropolitan Police to start using retrospective facial recognition as part of a 3 million four-year deal with the Japanese NEC Corporation. Ella Jakubowska from European Digital Rights said, those deploying it can in effect turn back the clock to see who you are, where you've been, what you have done, and with whom for many months or even years prior. So this is a retrospective tool which, if you consider this coming in force in addition to live facial recognition, let's say that, as we have already talked about, this is happening in the context of an ongoing crime against humanity being carried out by governments against their citizens. And if you add this element, I think it becomes very dangerous to let this go on unchallenged, in the sense that, let's say they decide that they don't like someone, they can go look, they can go backwards in time with all this surveillance and decide to also maybe engineer some kind of event through some kind of CCTV camera, and then say that you are guilty for this event. At the same time, they can then use a PCR form of the DNA testing or equivalent to then say that it has been found that your genetic material has been found at this location. But all of this, we know, can be totally engineered if it has been done at such a high level scale, which means that unfortunately this is a system is entirely open to abuse and to perpetrate further potential crimes against humanity. Which brings us to the question of the what is the so-called smart city? Now, what it actually is the opposite of what politicians and tech giants are saying it is, in the sense of it's not a smart in any shape or form for their citizens, because it's a tool of social and hierarchical control. And paraphrasing who coined the word bio-urbanism, and this is my own quote, but it's sort of inspired from him, smart cities are for stupid people. Smart cities are for gullible citizens. That is the reality of the smart city. It is not smart in any shape or form. The better word that we want to look at, if we want to look at an alternative direction, is wise. So wise in the sense of having a human purpose, dignity, meaningfulness, and a wise city despite this technology, because this technology is not neutral. This smartness, so-called smartness, is not an innocent addition to the city. And this idea that knowledge is data as opposed to critical thinking is completely on the wrong track when it comes to the interests of the citizens, which would actually be the sort of the wise city that we are interested in, would be a city that does not, that encourages critical thinking and therefore action, which comes from critical thinking, but not only data related to passive consumptions, obedience and control by authority. Which leads me into the subject again of language. We have been using a lot of words which relate to the history of systems which have oppressed individuals and citizens. We use the word very often totalitarianism. Now, there is an interesting discussion in this book, which is The Age of Surveillance Capitalism by Shoshana Zuboff. An interesting aspect of this book is that it is a Barack Obama pick of 2019. Therefore, if Barack Obama had any interest in informing us of anything that is happening at certain levels of the United States, I think this is as close as we got to it. In this book, a new category is introduced, and it's the category of instrumentarianism. Instrumentarianism as a market project that converges with the digital to achieve its own unique brand of social domination. Essentially, it substitutes so-called smart machines and also smart cities for social relations. In that respect, if you think about what the lockdowns actually were, the lockdown is in many ways the triumph of instrumentarianism. The social relations carried out in a physical way are substituted through smart, in the sense the use of AI to decide what information you receive and what whether you will be cancelled or not, substitutes your social relations and filters them through machines. So in the whole plethora of reasoning of what control mechanisms and what also disease-inducing capabilities the lockdown had, entirely counterproductive on all sorts of elements, I actually see it primarily as an instrumentarian tool. I like to encourage this book for people to go and do further research if they're interested in this subject. And I would ask people to look at chapter 15 of Shoshana Zuboff's The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. Chapter 15 is called The Instrumentarian Collective. And it mentions one particular name. It mentions Alex Pentland, the director of Human Dynamics Lab, interesting words, Human Dynamics Lab, at MIT's Media Lab. The book claims that Alex Pentland advises the World Economic Forum, Google, and the UN Secretary General. At the same time, the book claims that he is funded by Google, Twitter, the EU Commission, the US government, and the Chinese government. He is, I believe, the author of a book which is, again, going down the rabbit hole further. It's called Social Physics, and that, I believe, is a book by Alex Pentland himself. Again, interesting words, social physics. If we remember what we were told at the beginning of the alleged pandemic, which we should rename as the beginning of the crimes against humanity, we were talked to in terms of social distancing. Now, something that Agamben, Giorgio Agamben, the Italian philosopher, noticed, a philosopher of biopolitics noticed, was that this word, why social, why not physical distancing, why not, you know, sort of viral distancing? The word social was, in a way, very honest on their side, in the sense that the instrumentarian substitution of smart machines for social relations is integrated already in the word social distancing, and it has a recall in this title of this book by Pentland called Social Physics. And quoting her, she says, Pentland understands instrumentarian society as a historical turning point comparable to the invention of the printing press or the internet. This new collective intelligence operates to serve the greater good. Again, this word was already floating around in 2019 in this book, and obviously probably floating around long before in this social physics book. But it's clearly one of these trigger keywords that has been used specifically to achieve this desired social physics. But it is used in this book, this idea of the greater good. As we learn to act in a coordinated manner, based on, and this is also another two interesting words, social universals. So for me, this is giving it away that there is a coordinated effort to not only strip away the human rights that I mentioned under UNESCO, but to replace them with the new concept, which comes straight from this hierarchical control of so-called social universals. But you know, these are basically created in a media lab in a US university funded by big tech and big government. So this is not something that we have achieved, you know, after a world war like the Nuremberg Code, after sort of, you know, debates on human rights and bioethics like UNESCO. This is basically someone saying, I've got a plan here. I am stripping away your human rights, and I am telling you what the social universals are. Now, he's also aware that this will not be a walk in the park, because people like me and you and many others will say, hold on a minute. So he started to look at barriers. And so he thought, how do we overcome these barriers? And quoting again the book, it says, the main barriers are privacy concerns. This is why I mentioned the smart city and surveillance, because I think we need to, in a way, double down on our human rights and actually ask for more human rights than we already have. And I would like to encourage and ask that if we manage through the Corona Investigative Committee to set up a group that is able to hold some kind of accountability or evidence, that we also create a new form of code, not only hold on to the Nuremberg Code, but we create a new form of code to do with privacy and surveillance and living in the smart city, and to make sure that it cannot happen either now or ever again in the future, that a government that is controlled by, let's say, oligarchic or other interests is able to implement such systematic violation of human rights through technology. So I encourage that we don't only defend our human rights, but we start a conversation to have a new document of human rights that deals with the surveillance and the smart city. So he says, the fact that we don't yet have any consensus around the trade-off between personal and social values. So this is sort of an interesting way to start to claim a moral high horse as to what the oligarchic interests are, to say that they are our new social values. Here they are, and they are for you to be more altruistic. But in reality, I am thinking them out together with big tech and government and various agencies involved. So the main tool, Zuboff in that respect is honest enough because she says, Pentland avoids the question, who's greater good? Because obviously the question is here, it's not our greater good, it's not our social values for us. The element that is used, that we have witnessed in the last 2 years in an unprecedented way, is social pressure. So the, you know, from this interpretation of Pentland, the social physics approach to getting everyone to cooperate to Pentland's greater good is social network incentives. So what we see as, you know, likes, reposts, comments, you know, these are all small incentives that if they are able to manipulate those, then they are able to direct people in certain directions. It's when people put their images of being in, you know, having had the injections and put a poster, photo on Instagram saying, you know, I got injected, you got a lot of likes and you feel great. So these are all obviously calculated. And that's why in one respect, I prefer the Telegram option, which does not have likes. I think the more we can strip away these social network incentives, the better it is. I mean, reposts have a purpose, comments have a purpose, but I think likes is pure dopamine addiction, and it will be used against us in the long term. And so they looked at how could they leverage those exchanges to generate social pressure for change. And, you know, they obviously looked at what people do on Facebook. People love to put their holiday pictures up, and they say, okay, we're going to take their holidays away off until they conform to what we want to do. Pentland subscribes to the label Homo imitans, so not Homo sapiens, but Homo imitans. So this new category of human being, you know, some people call it a transhumanist that they're trying to create, which is based on social universals, which can be molded through social physics. This particular person is called Homo imitans, and he works through imitating others. They've been extremely successful at this. I mean, we must admit they've been extremely successful. And so he subscribes to this label to convey that it is mimicry, not empathy. So it is not empathy. And we have noticed, because every time we have shown any form of injuries for these injections, the last thing we got from the people who got the injection is any empathy whatsoever for all the victims that now are in the millions of these injections. Millions of victims, zero empathy. Why? Because it is easier to imitate through the social media what the majority of the people on your network who are also controlled through AI are doing, rather than show any empathy, which may make you look as a sort of, social misfit. And certainly not politics either, which defines human existence anymore. The largest single factor driving adoption of the new behaviors, you know, this is essentially the new normal. What is it? Is the new behavior that is molded through the social physics of the instrumentarian collective, is the behavior of peers. Now, obviously, this leads to the question of a form of social physics tyranny, which also Zuboff does not shy away from using. And she writes, tyranny is not a word that I choose lightly. Like the instrumentarian hive, like the beehive, tyranny is the obliteration of politics. Hannah Arendt observed that the tyranny is a perversion of egalitarianism. That's also an interesting view of seeing it, and we have seen it in the last 2 years, a perversion of egalitarianism, because it treats all others as equally insignificant. Now, the in terms of architecture, there's someone in England that has been speaking as well as I have, who are architects for social housing, and Simon Elmer, who wrote a number of books. One of them is called Virtue and Terror. He has an interview here with Frida Wiesel, and he writes something which I find interesting to do with the city and where we're going, because he says, I think we are undoubtedly going through a revolution, or what Kennedy calls a coup. And he talks about the Industrial Revolution, and he says they had to drive a primarily rural population off the land and into the cities to provide the workforce for the Industrial Revolution. And the only way they could really do that was to simply impoverish them so that the working class had to go to the cities. Now, if you think about that, and you think about what the lockdowns did to the middle classes and to people with small businesses who maybe were running it from outside the city through some kind of internet business, or maybe even local farming businesses and selling to shops. And the lockdown is clearly a tool to impoverish people. Social upheaval, you know, like maybe now we are witnessing in Kazakhstan or possibly other countries, is also once a private property gets damaged, set on fire, it's also a tool to impoverish people. People cannot draw cash from machines. Now, if you hold that thought for a second and look at the way the city is being set up, the so-called smart city, it's clearly a trap. The impoverishment drives people to where they perceive there is the only work left, which can be corporations or can be governments. Ultimately, that's what they want, everyone to be dependent on government. And the only place where you can work for the government, ultimately, is the smart city. And in that smart city, you are under total control, retrospective control, facial recognition, QR codes. And you have no other option, because what we suggested in a group, again, this idea, this word coined by my colleague Stefano Serafino, this word of bio-urbanism, is a counter-movement to all of this. Now, they are trying to make it impossible for us to have a counter movement, because they are trying to impoverish anyone who could survive on this counter movement. So the surveillance city, the smart city, is the trap. And in a way, the lockdown impoverishment is the tool to lead everyone into that. The wise thing to do would be to resist that. And until we can actually resist it, to probably live in a safe distance from the city. But it's very difficult for a lot of us, including me at present. I live in the city. And so we have no option, I think, than to fight it. And that's why I think people who see this only in terms of, the people will realize that the corona issue was a fraud and they will wake up. Yes, but if that happens once the smart city is implemented, it's too late. We need to fight on at least that area as well. So that, yeah.
Very important points, like also what you, like when you talk about this, the social physics, it's really a question also that people like during these 2 years have been like kind of almost like animals, trained to function in that sort of sense. So it's become like sort of a habit for a lot of people to act in that way and like to always kind of withdraw themselves from understanding what their own needs are, because it's for the greater good that you make all these compromises in and accept these things that usually you wouldn't have or even you think it's necessary. So I think it's also like really some intense kind of conditioning, maybe in order to then get people into this ever smarter cities with like less and less options. Like I saw a little clip about the situation in China where you have to you always have to present your QR code if you want to go there and to other places. And then they even have areas that you cannot travel to anymore because there's maybe a red zone with regards to coronavirus, or then it might be other things like climate problems or whatever. But it's like really stepping back from your own needs, from your own you know, inalienable basic rights, you know, and accepting that for the greater good. So I think it's a kind of cleverly set up, but more and more people are also starting to resist that and are starting to realize what's going on.
I think this is what this boils down to, what all of us are looking at from different angles, and what we're beginning to see clearer and clearer. Because last night in an interview, I said, well, if we have a puzzle with 1,000 pieces over the last 2 years, I think we have collected at least 990 of these pieces. So despite the fact that there's still a few pieces missing, we can very clearly see now that this is us against the oligarch. You're describing the same thing, Robin. And what we have done over the last, let's say, 2 months or 3 months now, is we have joined a group of international lawyers. We have collected all the evidence that we have, and we're going to show this in a grand jury proceeding. We're going to show this to the jury. The jury is the people. We want the people to see what has been going on. And we want them to be able to make up their own minds based on the real truth, on the actual truth, because there is a truth out there. Most people have understood in the meantime that they've been lied to by their governments, which are not their governments anymore, by the mainstream media. We want to provide them with the facts. We also want to give them a legal analysis of what these facts mean. You probably have heard of Mike Yeadon is going to explain to us a little later on how he has come across, this is what he calls it, compelling evidence for premeditated mass murder. That's what it is. This is what it boils down to. We're going to give them the facts. We're going to give them the legal analysis, not just because we want indictments against these four defendants, Drosten, Fauci, Tedros, and Gates, but much more importantly is the fact that we want the people to have a basis, legal and factual basis, on which they can decide this is our time. We have to rise up, because that's the only way to turn this thing around. Of course, our legal institutions will have to do the cleanup work. We do have serious doubts that the current legal institutions are capable of doing this. But we're going to go forward. We're going to take the first step. And then I think there's going to be another, I wouldn't call it Nuremberg 2.0, because Nuremberg didn't really work. As we all know, through Operation Paperclip, all of the real criminals got away. They started the space program in the United States, but they also started the MKUltra program in the United States.
Absolutely.
So this time is going to be different. That's why we need all this input. And your view, from a completely different perspective, is extremely helpful here. We have to connect. We have to exchange all these views, get them all into the open, expose what's going on, give the people an opportunity to understand that it's not just reasonable, but it's necessary for us to rise up and fight these bastards and send them back to hell where they came from. I don't want to be rude, Robin, but Dr. Lee Merritt has been waiting. I don't want to cut you off, so please.
I actually, remarkable timing, because I had just finished my presentation.
Perfect. Robin, it's a real pleasure. We're going to be in touch, because I know we're going to want to hear more from you.
Great. Thank you so much for having me on, and I look forward to listening to Lee Merritt.
Thank you very much.